Hello and welcome to Paul's Podcast Diary, Season 5, Episode 18, for Saturday the 13th of May, 2023. Coming up this week, Book 3 has been edited and it's now with my wife for her review and comments. The ebook covers for my trilogy arrived this week. I'll be gearing up for pre-orders soon. And we're on our way to Hull and Rotterdam next week, but 50% of it will be work-related, of course. Let's start with my editing update this week. Book 3, The Fifth Girl. My edit is now finished. I finished it by the skin of my teeth just before I started recording this podcast because yesterday I'd signed off yesterday for a jolly. We went out for lunch, went to the cinema, and I went for a run, a club run in the evening. So I'd meant to get some editing done yesterday and it just didn't happen because fun got in the way. So I had to do about 11 chapters today and I was sitting there in my pyjamas. And I just thought, I must start early, I mustn't get distracted, get my head down and get this editing done. So I did get it finished, it's done, it's processed, it's passed to my wife, it's off my, or out of my in tray for a week or so at least, until my wife takes a look at it and gives me a load of her observations and corrections. Now, I was very pleased when I read through it, because it was written out of order, if you remember. I think I'd left some of the 60s scenes and written... Well, obviously, I'd written the final two chapters before I even started writing the book, and then I'd written out of order. So in terms of my experience of the book, it was quite hickledy-pickledy. So this is the first time I've actually read it all the way through in the correct order. I'm delighted to say that everything worked. I think I had to just erase maybe two short paragraphs just because they didn't make any sense in terms of what had happened. I think I had about three different names for my killer, so I had to settle on a name and do a find and replace to get rid of all the duffer names, because you didn't really know the name until right at the end. So I'd obviously just made something up as I'd gone along, and then I had to obviously make that consistent throughout the book. So those were the main changes that I had to make. But yeah, it all made sense. It all came together. It's always a blessed relief when you write a trilogy and it all does work and the slow release of information comes together. So as I say, my wife will read that now. She really only does a superficial edit on it, which is that she reads it as a reader might, and she just lets me know anything she spots, anything that confuses her or doesn't work, or anything in the plot where she says, hang on a minute, what's this all about? So it's a fairly superficial edit, but it is very useful for me, and it's the first pair of external eyes that I get on the book. I will now move tomorrow, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. That's dedicated to working through Claire Cronchell's edits and suggestions on book two. So Claire has sent me, I don't work through the minutiae. So I've got a track changes document from Claire, which has absolutely everything on. Now I do scan that. Perhaps I'll give her the impression that I don't take any notice of that. I do always scan it, but I don't work through every single change and say, oh yes, that one's okay, this one isn't okay, that one's okay, this one isn't okay. I don't do that. Because that would just take forever. And to me, that's almost like your boss breathing down your neck saying, oh, I wouldn't have put that. I wouldn't have put that. You know, it's just, it's too much. So I accept the track changes because the book's going to get another read from me again anyway. And if there's something I don't like the way it's phrased or anything, then it will occur to me as a reader when I'm giving it those last reads. So, you know, this isn't me handing it over, never going to look at it again. So if there's something that troubles me elsewhere, you know, use of language or something like that, I could change it. It could still be changed by me anyway, before it gets released to readers. So, you know, I'm happy to accept the track changes. I think there's about 90, I think, things that I need to look at. And by need to look at, looking at the way Claire did things last time, she'd usually made a suggestion or just pointed up a change that she'd made that she felt I needed to be aware of. So we're not talking about things like a spelling mistake or a bit of punctuation. We're talking about maybe a word choice change or something like that that she just flags up. And I'll either accept it or reject it. Just go through the list. And as I say, I've got 4 days now. That'll be more than enough to work through those changes in book two. I'll get those done before we go away next week. And when I come back from going to Hull and Rotterdam, which I'll be talking to you about later in the show, I will then sit down and read book two thoroughly, go through it with a fine tooth comb. So that's my edits, my wife edits, Claire's edits, read it as a reader, and make changes. Sometimes a sentence might jar, or I might read a sentence and think, "Oh, hang on, that doesn't make sense." Or because of the word choice, I might have to read it again because it didn't quite scan correctly. So it's really just very superficial changes at that stage. I'll then turn it into an EPUB file, put it into BookFunnel, and it can sit there and wait until before it goes to the beta readers. Now, I have scheduled a final edit for all the books. So there's a lot of editing involved here. I'm going to do the final edit. I'm going to do Claire's edit, then my final edit, then it will go to beta readers for book two. When it comes back from beta readers, I will work through the changes, any queries that they've made in those books. And I'll do that with all three books, but they will all get a final all the way through read before they then get released. And that's really just to make sure, a last minute check by me to make sure I haven't introduced any errors into the book. And if there's any last minute things that I spot that I want to tweak or change, I've still got an opportunity to do that. So although the books are written, it's just going to go through and through and through edit processes until we refine and hopefully make it as good as it can be before it gets released. So one thing that did occur to me this week, and this was based on listening to the Selmore Book Show again this week, and they had a really good topic. They were discussing changes to KDP and TikTok book publishing. But also, I had heard about a blog post. Joanna Penn had mentioned it in this week's podcast, and it was a blog post by Christine Catherine Rush. It's a really long blog post. I'll put the link on the show notes this week. It was such a long blog post that I actually did quite a nice thing that Christine had done, that she had, it's such a long blog post, she gets it voiced up by an AI, and then you can download the audio and listen to it. And I, for large pieces of large blogs like that, I actually prefer to listen because I could be doing something else while I'm listening to it. So I actually downloaded the audio and listened to it in audio form. And that was, it was a really good blog, but it was basically in favour of going wide and keeping out of KDP Select, just talking about changes in the industry. And then the Selmore Book Show were picking up on that, but also picking up on the talking point that TikTok are now doing book publishing as well, and really just talking about changes in the industry. Now, they had a great discussion, I thought, about it. Claire comes up with some very pertinent, balanced points, I think, about these topics. And so it's well worth listening to Selmore Book Show on this topic, but also read the blog post, which I've put on the show notes this week as well, by Christine Catherine Rush. The basic point is that Amazon are laying loads of people off, that the payouts for if you're in KDP Select are going down, and really just warning alarm bells that it might be time to start pivoting to going wide. Now, I've told you before that I've long ago accepted that wide is a much more cautious sort of career protecting way of listing your books. But unfortunately, I make too much money out of being in KDP Select to just turn that source of income off and go for it. You know, over 50% of my income comes from reads. So I can't just switch that off, unfortunately. But what did occur to me this week is what I can do is I can make this series, this latest series that I'm doing, I could list that wide. That doesn't have to be in KDP Select, because I got plenty of units in KDP Select that are bringing that income in. But I thought what I would do, I've only got one thriller listed wide, that's the Now You See Her book. So I thought, well, I might as well with this series, we'll at least start it wide and see if there's any compelling reason for me to change it. But I will launch it wide, I think, when we start off. But also, when we the plan at the moment is to launch book one in October, book two in November, book three in December, and then move to the box set in January. And when I've got the box set available, I will start to list that book for BookBub promos, and I will go to list book one for free. That will be my strategy. Now, I haven't had a BookBub in ages, and of course my psychological thrillers are in KDP Select, so I'm hoping that having a thriller series wide might help me to land another BookBub on that new series. That's the strategy I'm going to do. Now, of course, you could always switch later on if you want to, but I think this is going to go wide. Unless I find a compelling reason to change my mind in between now and October, I'm going to list these wide when I launch them. In terms of marketing this week, I've got an Amazon promo on my Morecambe Bay 9 box set. Now, this is tied up. If you recall, I said to you that what I wanted to do is be more meticulous about using all of the promos that I'm offered by Amazon when I'm in KDP Select. I haven't been using them, and frankly, you might as well promote all of your books, even if you just list them free for a week, just to generate a little bit of interest on them. Now, it's not worth me promoting all of those on Facebook, but some of them it is. So I will be running a week-long Facebook advert on my Morecambe Bay 9-pack, and that will run in the US only between Monday the 15th and Sunday the 22nd. And it's on a Kindle Countdown deal at 99 cents, that box set. So again, it's just there to create a little flurry, hopefully, of sales. With Amazon ads this week, I started Matthew J. Holmes's training. I actually decided to park it until after I got the book three edits done, because that was the thing I had to get done this week. I needed to get that out of the way and get it chugging through the system so it's ready for Claire in June. I think it's ready, yeah, it's due about a month today to Claire, so plenty of time. I said to my wife, I've got plenty of time to read that today. But I do want to get on with the Matthew J. Holmes training. Now, I did a little bit of it, and we were straight into the stats, and I've got to say, I'm terrible. I've got a real blind spot when we talk about all this stat stuff. It's just, all I hear is blah, 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 blah. And by complete contrast, when I was doing the setting up stuff, when somebody's telling me what to do and showing me what to do along the way, I'm all in there. I'm completely engaged with that. But the minute we start going slightly abstract and talking about percentages and this, that, and the other, I'm away with the fairies. You know, I find it really difficult to focus. So I will admit to you that having started a video or two this week, I started to search through my emails, because originally when I discovered Matthew's content and started working through the videos, I thought, do you know what I'm going to do is I'm just going to pay him to do it for me. Now, he stopped doing that, but he did recommend somebody that I could use. And I thought, at the time, I'd rather just use Matthew, actually. And so I was trying to find the email that Matthew sent me with the name of this person on it. I can't find it in my emails at the moment, but I did think, do you know what? I might just skip this training and pay someone to do it and see if they can make it work for me. Because, I will admit, I really have got a block with this Amazon stuff. It's terrible. But I could push through most things, but it just bores me senseless, the Amazon stuff. It's just way too complicated for my brain to want to even begin to tackle. Now, as I said to you, I've got a couple of Amazon ads that are working perfectly well. They're in profit and they're doing well. And I did notice the other day, let me have a quick look. I don't know whether it's still the case, but I was delighted to see that in my also boughts, I was getting Joy Ellis, who is I think the best-selling author with Joffa Books. And she was coming up in my also boards. So let me just check if that's the case. See, I told you I can't type and talk. I just put Paul J. Ellis there, which is nonsense, obviously. So let me just go to my author page and see what's going on here. Is she still there? LJ Ross is still there, which is great. Peter James is in there. Mike Yarwood is in there. Oh, Joy Ellis is still there. Great. So Joy Ellis is still in there. The two that I really want at the moment are Joy Ellis and LJ Ross, which is fabulous. So they are still in my also boards. Even at a small level, I'm getting some benefit from those Amazon ads, which I didn't have before, which was elusive to me previously. So anyhow, let's see how it goes. Well, now I'm clear of book three. I might be more settled when I come and do this Amazon ads training, because it becomes my main focus. BookBub, I've had another rejection this week. The Morecambe Bay 3-pack was rejected, and another month has passed, so I've tried my luck again with my 12-pack, which I would love to get listed on BookBub at 99 pence and cents. I hope I'm right, but I feel sure that that would fly off the shelves and that it would give me a real, really big page read boost. But, they don't seem interested in it for some reason. I just don't know why they're not interested in it. 3,500 reviews at 4. Whatever it is, you would think they'd go for it. So I really don't know what their criteria are. But anyhow, I'll keep trying. I'll just keep trying. And I'll just keep, you know, submitting the same old things until I get new books available. And then I'll focus on trying to get one of those listed in BookBub, my new series. I've got lots of other writing-related news for you this week. It's been a busy old week, actually. An interesting old week, because I sent off to Elizabeth Mackie to get my book covers done for the new series. And I've now got those back. We did them faster than I thought. Now, I said to you last week, I always get a bit nervous when I send a book order off because you never quite know what's going to come back and whether you're going to be happy with it. And one of the things I was quite keen to do with this series is to have covers on the books that were immediately noticeable if you live in the local area. Now, clearly my audience isn't just a Hull audience, but I do want them to recognise the scenes on the certainly the covers of the first books, because you've got two audiences there. Obviously, you've got a Hull audience, so you get that local word of mouth going, hopefully. But also, you've got a national, international audience who just want to read the stories. It doesn't really matter where they're set to them as well. So Elizabeth sent me a couple of covers back, a couple of trial covers, which I didn't like originally. Now, the problem with those covers was the scenes, the design, everything was fine. The layout, the colorization, everything was fine. But she'd been trying to find some female models, and she sent me a note back saying it's very difficult to get female models which haven't been used already by everybody else. And I'd also said to her, look, I expect that I will write more books in this series unless it falls flat. I expect to write more books in the series, and in which case, whichever female model we use, we need to make sure we can remain consistent across the series, which may have several books in it. The first demos that Elizabeth sent me, the first one, the lady looked like she was on a night out. She looked far too posh and she'd got heels on, and where the character was placed, in actual fact, she was on like the marshy soil alongside the Humber estuary, so she'd have got sucked up by the sand if she'd have been in high heels in that environment. But also, my character, I always make a big deal about her wearing flats. She doesn't wear heels because she needs to run, so she needs to wear flat shoes. So that wasn't right, and the dress wasn't right either, the way she was dressed. And then in the other one, in actual fact, she was wearing a coat, which is what I wanted to have, and it was pictured from behind. But the woman had some bizarre hat on. I don't know what the hat was. Now, if you were writing one of these quirky detectives and you'd written it as a quirk of the detective that she always wore this very distinctive hat, then that would have been fine. But when I saw the hat, everything else was right, but the hat was completely wrong. And of course, this is a British detective, and you've got to have the person on the cover, you know, dressed as a British detective would be. Now, if I was writing a cozy crime and I had a more quirky detective or investigator, then the hat would have been fine. The images and the lady that was used was perfect for it, but that hat was a no-go for me. So I took a deep breath and wrote back to Elizabeth. I went hunting and found some other pictures that I thought were the right sort of thing. Elizabeth then, with that extra guidance, came back to me with three covers, and they were spot on for what I wanted. She got basically a brunette woman of indeterminable age, but you know, Kate's in her 40s, and she was just wearing a generic coat, and that's what I wanted for the scenes. And then we got three very distinctive Hull scenes. If you live in Hull or know Hull, you'll know those scenes. And then the rest of the designs I was quite happy with. So that's fantastic. I said, yep, that's great, happy with those, and we committed to those. I got them paid for. I also then created 3D versions. So Elizabeth sends me the flat covers. I took the flat covers and I just paid for a month of My Cover Maker. I don't like the graphics that BookBrush makes, not the 3D graphics. They're just a little bit ropey for me. We used to get graphics done when I was in internet marketing, and some of them just didn't work. And they're just the proportions of the 3D books just aren't quite right for me on BookBrush. I don't like them. I wouldn't use them. So I use My Cover Maker, where for my tastes, the three book 3D renderings are perfect. I paid about $15 for a month of My Cover Maker, and when I pay for a month of My Cover Maker, I make all sorts of different views and versions of the books while I've got the upgraded membership. So I got the 3D versions, and then I went on to Fiverr and used the person that I used to make my 3D box sets, and it costs, I think it's $4.97, I think it is, was the price that I was charged. I always tip double because I can't. For what you pay, $4 or $5 for what I got. I got four different versions of the box sets, and they're turned around really fast. I'm always very keen to support people who do good quality fast work, and particularly people that I want to use a lot of the time. So I doubled that and paid $15 for it, because that's worth my while to have a good job done. And this person always does a good job. It's one of these, I don't know what the name of the contractor is. I couldn't even tell you what the business is, but I've used them for all of my 3D box sets over a couple of years now, and I always get a great job done. So I've got all the covers done now, and so I'm all ready to go to do all sorts of promos. We're all good to go. All I've got to do is finish the books, of course. Now I added the graphics and coming soon headers to my Facebook and Twitter pages. So that's my author Facebook author page and my Twitter page. They've now got coming soon and pictures of the three books on them. And I've also added the books at paulteague.net. I've put a coming soon message there, but obviously I haven't got them on pre-sale yet. And while I was working with Elizabeth, I dropped her a note, because Elizabeth created the cover for Now You See Her. I dropped her a note and said, do you do the Square audiobook covers? And she's also provided the audiobook cover for Now You See Her. Now, that audiobook is a slow burn project with no deadline attached. So I just thought, oh, while I'm here, I'm going to get, while Elizabeth is doing some work for me, I'll get that Square graphic done as well. So that's already in the pot for when the audiobook arrives, and I need to start listening through to it and proofing it. So it's been, from a graphics point of view, it's been a really productive week. And I must say, it feels much more exciting. I've written three books now, but until I see those 3D renderings of the covers, even I don't feel that excited. But when you see the covers like that, you really get a sense that you've actually created something tangible. So I've got quite excited now. I can look at the covers and start to promote those and share those. That's fantastic. I don't do big cover reveal things or anything like that, because I don't particularly feel that there's anybody who particularly cares. You know, I just share the things when I've got them and let everybody see them. I don't do any kind of slow burn promotion. Maybe if I felt that I had a zillion fans waiting to buy them, I might do. But at the moment, I just let people see them as soon as they're there. I don't do any big build up. Nor do I frankly feel that psychological thriller audience particularly cares for that. I see it done more in fantasy, and it works very well there. But I haven't particularly seen a lot of a big deal made of covers with psychological thrillers. So it's not something that I would do, would suit my personality type. So I just let people see them as soon as they've arrived. But yeah, very exciting week as far as the covers is concerned. But all that artwork is now done. I wanted to just provide a little bit of clarification about the Matthew J. Holmes courses that I've bought and that I'm using. Just for complete clarity with this, because on a couple of podcasts I hear people talking about them, and I just wanted to be very clear where I am with the courses. So the Amazon Ads course is the first course that I did, and for my learning style, the first 50% of that, which shows you how to set up the adverts, that is the best and the clearest course that I've seen. So I've 50% completed that course, and the setups and the explanation of how to set up all the ad types were brilliant. Now, I've already told you about my difficulties going through the rest. Now, again, Matthew's training is the clearest step-by-step training I've seen. So if I am going to complete Amazon Ads training, it's most likely it's going to happen with his training, because it's methodical, step by step. There's no sort of waffle in there at all. You just get on with it. And, so it's the training I'm most likely to finish, but I haven't finished that last 50% of the training just yet. Now, as far as the Facebook course is concerned, I bought the first Facebook course really because I liked his training style. My Facebook ads are going fine, but that doesn't mean that you can't learn from somebody else who's doing better than you. So I bought the first Facebook course. There wasn't a lot in there that I didn't know already, but what it did confirm is the information that I'd taken from the first Facebook training I did, which was Mark Dawson's training. The procedures that I was using for that were correct. And it showed you how to do most of that stuff over the course of one or two videos. Now, there are a couple of other things in there that I wasn't aware of that I learned, but the Facebook training wasn't as much value to me as the Amazon ads training, because I knew and knew a lot of it, but the few videos that did show me stuff that I wasn't aware of were massively valuable to me. So I'm completely happy that I bought the Facebook course. And also, since I did that original Facebook course, Matthew has updated it, and I need to go through the new Facebook course, which brings us bang up to date. Now, again, I've said this about Mark Dawson's training. I bought the Facebook course, goodness knows how many years ago, at full price for about £500. And ever since I bought that, obviously the Facebook course itself with Mark Dawson's training has been updated, but I've had all sorts of extra courses added to it anyway, so it's been of immense value to me. And Matthew did the same as that too, that the new Facebook course just got put into my account. I didn't have to pay any extra for that. So it's been great value. Now, I would happily have bought those because I really like Matt's training style. But of course, the Facebook training was nowhere near as useful to me as the Amazon course has been. And remember also, I haven't done that new Facebook course yet. Now, there's another training which I haven't touched, and I won't touch because I'm just not interested to. I'm just not in the zone. And that's the 60-minute author training that he's just released. I haven't bought that. It doesn't sort of interest me. I just don't feel like I'm in the zone for that. But that doesn't mean that it wouldn't be useful to you. I just felt that it was for probably newer authors, that I felt that was a more general course for newer authors. And I haven't bought that, and I won't be buying that one. What I would recommend to you is, as I've said all along, don't buy anything until you've signed up for Matthew's emails, you've listened to the previous podcast content, because they are all free and they're packed with information. You don't have to buy anything. You get loads of information just from the previous podcast or the email content. And my advice to you would be, see if the teaching style suits you, because it might not. You might respond to a completely different teaching style to what I do. And then you've got an opportunity to decide for yourself without parting with any of your money. So what I'm telling you to do is do your due diligence, consume the, there's so much free stuff there, literally. You don't have to buy anything. You could just exist on the free content, because it's great. There's loads of information in there. But if you then feel inspired to go and buy the courses, because you like the style, that's entirely up to you. Go ahead and do that. But that's the sort of sequence that I did, and I'm happy with the courses that I've bought. But I think that if you're strapped for cash, if you really have to think about buying the courses, then you should definitely do your due diligence first, because I think it's really important that you choose a trainer who has a teaching style that suits you, and what suits me won't necessarily suit you. I also wanted to just bring you up to date with the technical transitions in my business. This is where I'm up to with the tech that I'm using at the moment. So I'm transitioning, as you know, from Gmail to Proton Mail at the moment. And I'm getting on very well with it. I'm working entirely in Proton Mail at the moment. And this means basically it ensures your encryption of your emails. No one reads or accesses your emails. It strips out certain advertising or snooping elements in the emails. It's easier if you just read the front page for Proton Mail to see what it does. But my feeling is, in the way that I transitioned early to Gmail, when Gmail was the best option, my feeling, if I'm reading the tea leaves, is that something like Proton Mail is going to be the sort of service that we all start to move on into as privacy becomes a bigger and bigger issue in our online work. So I'm making an early pivot to Proton Mail. Now, you have to pay for Proton Mail, but there's one thing that's just clinched it. Proton Mail gives me loads of technical things that I want. It allows me to bring in domain named emails. So if you send an email to me at paul@paulteague.net, it will be I've set it up so it automatically picks it up off the servers from Proton Mail. So it lets me do some cool things like that with up to three domain names. It gives me a VPN, which I use quite a lot. Well, I use virtually all the time, actually, VPNs, which are, again, a security issue. And it gives me encrypted file storage. Now, the file storage is not as useful as Google's is, because Google allows you to open Google Docs, Excel spreadsheets within the browser. The Proton Mail doesn't allow you to do that, but it does give you secure file storage. If you've got confidential stuff that you want to store online, then that's a much better storage option, probably. Now, the thing that's absolutely clinched it for me with Proton Mail is that they now bundle with that paid Proton Mail package a password manager. And over the last week or so, I've been using their password manager. So I exported my passwords from LastPass. I imported them into the Proton Mail password manager, and I'm instantly getting on with it extremely well. For something that's in beta testing, it's pretty brilliant. And the big thing with, and I'm not going to go into technical recommendations, I'm going to just suggest if this is something that interests you, or if you were caught in the data breach with LastPass, that you just read the web pages that they've got on this, because they'll explain all the tech to you. But the way that the passwords are encrypted is much safer than the way that it's done with LastPass and many other password managers. So I'm instantly getting on well with this password manager. So that's really clinched it with me, because normally I would pay for a VPN separately. I used to pay for a VPN through Avast. Password manager, I used to pay through LastPass. I used to get their paid for service. And so with the price of the VPN and the password manager, that effectively makes the email free to me. So it's going to take a lot for me to stop using Proton Mail now. And I think I mentioned this to you either last week or the week before. You're allowed to offer suggestions for improvement. There's one thing in Proton Mail that I'd like them to do, which Gmail does, and lots of other people want them to do it too. And that is where you can just pause emails. You can, it's like a boomerang. You can say, pause this for 5 days, or return this email to me in a month's time. And I find that very handy with subscriptions and things like that. I use it a lot in Gmail. That's the only thing I'm missing at the moment, but I know they're working on it, and it's going to come soon in Proton Mail. So when they get that, it's going to be just like Gmail from a user point of view. So that's Proton Mail. I've talked to you about that a couple of times. But again, you know, if you're in Gmail, whatever you're using, if you're quite happy with it, that's fine. But I mentioned these things just in case they're of interest to you, or if it's something that's on your personal radar. I've got Bing, the Bing search engine on my PC for the first time in years, because I had a look at the interface the other day, and of course they've now incorporated ChatGPT. And if you look at the Bing interface now, it pretty well is ChatGPT. So Bing is now on my computer where I can get to it easily, because it's, as I say, it's literally a combination of a browser and ChatGPT. So you could get it all in one place, really. So I'm going to be playing around with that. It's nice to be back with Bing, the Bing browser. I'm also getting on extremely well with Living Writer at the moment. Now they've upgraded it to an app. Getting no problems with it at all. I've got nothing to say negative about it at all at the moment. And I really do want to have a cloud-based writing solution which allows me to access my work on any device. So Living Writer is £78 a year. The subscription for me is coming up in July. I've budgeted to renew that. I'm expecting to renew it in July, unless it does anything horrendous to me in the meantime. I'm doing some experiments with it in the background with some other ideas that I've got, and it's just working extremely well for me at the moment. I've been using it for this trilogy. I was going to write my current trilogy in it originally. Can't remember why I decided not to, but I have been taking notes and storing character details and setting details in Living Writer. So I've had the Living Writer files open all the way through what I've been working on this current trilogy. It's never done anything that bothered me in any way. It's nothing technical at all. So I'm getting on extremely well with Living Writer, and I think that looks like the cloud-based solution that I'm probably going to commit to next. I've also switched to the Brave browser. This is another browser which puts privacy first, and as you can tell, what I'm looking at is a gradual move. And it's going to be very difficult to do this, but I'm trying to make a gradual move away from Google. And this is really for a data privacy, data management point of view, really. And it's not something that massively bothers me, but because there are great solutions now available, I think, well, I figure I might as well. And Brave is a brilliant browser. It's a little bit like Proton Mail for something that's supposed to be new and in beta. It's brilliant straight out of the box. Now, the Brave browser puts privacy first. It blocks all the nasty trackers, but without a lot of blockers leave big gaps in your web pages, whereas what Brave does is it works in the background to block things that are tracking you. And if you need to, some sites you need things to track you. So for instance, in Amazon, I'm happy for Amazon to track me because I get better recommendations that way. But you could either switch them on or switch them off. The important thing is you've got full control over everything. Now, it works exactly like Chrome. And why I like the Brave browser is because it allows me to add all my apps from the Chrome store. So it looks exactly like Chrome, except it works slightly differently in the background. But I've now made the switch to Brave, and I'm getting on extremely well with it. The other thing that I'm doing in terms of tech and just embracing new technology is in next week's episode, which I'll tell you a little bit about later on, you're going to hear me using an AI voice tool for the first time on this podcast. So it's my aim to produce an AI narrated nonfiction book as soon as I can get to it, which I'm hoping might be this year. And I've just been playing around with a few AI voice tools, and I've actually used it to create product. I've already pre-recorded next week's podcast episode, and it uses AI voices for a very good reason. It would work better than if it was using my voice. So I've now used AI voices for the very first time to create a proper product, which you'll be able to listen to next week. At the moment, although I'm seeing some brilliant AI artwork, I'm just really hanging off AI artwork because I just want to know a little bit more about the copyright, legal and ethical clarifications with this. So I love AI artwork. I'm seeing an awful lot of it on Twitter. And I think I've heard various conversations about it, that obviously there's a difference between using AI artwork for pecuniary remuneration and maybe just putting something on Twitter. I am, obviously, because we write books and we have our own kind of rights on our books, I'm just as keen to respect artists' rights. So because I'm not quite sure where I sit with this, I'm looking at it, using it privately, but I just think I want to have a little bit more thinking time before I start using it in public, for anything public. But I am playing with it on the sidelines, and we've also got AI artwork within Canva now as well. So I'm very keen to use all of it, but I just need to be a little bit more, I think, certain in my mind about the kind of ethical, legal, copyright elements of using AI artwork online. I've had a discussion with one of my kids who produces artwork and sells artwork online, and I say, well, you know, one of the elements in this is that if you went to an art gallery, if you were an artist, say you're a painter, and you go to an art gallery and you look at lots of pictures on the walls and you are inspired by the art that you see, and then you go home and you paint a picture that it's inspired by the art that you see. Well, that's not stealing copyright. You're not copying somebody's work. You've been inspired by it. If I make a direct copy of somebody's work and then sell it and pass it off as theirs, well, that clearly is a copyright breach. And so where I am is, what I'm struggling with in my own mind at the moment is, if AI scans other artists' work and is inspired by that, i.e. it's not copying it, it's inspired by it, then I'm fairly comfortable that's not a breach of copyright. But if it uses elements of somebody's artwork, particular extracts from it, or copies somebody's artwork, then that quite clearly is a breach of copyright. And so I'm just not quite sure where I am with this. And I would also need to trust the AI that I was using, that it was ethical. It was a piece of ethical software. So that's where I am with AI artwork. So I'm playing around with it in the background and I am loving it, but I just want a little bit more clarification in my own mind about what to do with that. So I'm using quite a lot of tech in my business at the moment, using quite a lot of new things in my business, and it is AI informed. And for the very first time, as I say, in next week's episode, you actually get a podcast episode that uses AI for the first time ever. We're in Hull and Rotterdam next week. It's part business and part pleasure. Now, the big thing I've got to tell you about is the trip to the Hull barrage is off for now. The reason for that is that the days that I'm in Hull, I can't catch the two guys who need to show us around. So the day when I could take the tour, the guys are on a course. and then they're not available on the Monday when I can do it too. So that's fine because Hully's just across. It's when I stay with my mum, it's an hour's drive, not even an hour's drive from where my mum lives. So what I'll do is when I'm visiting my mum next, I'll rearrange it and just nip across the Humber Bridge and then rearrange it for another time. And to be honest with you, I've got two opportunities to do that before the books are even published. Two visits already scheduled to go and see my mum. So I don't anticipate a problem with that, but I can't do it this time around. The schedules, unfortunately, just don't work for us. Could have done it on the Friday, but we've sailed on the Friday, and I got my diary wrong at first. You do overnight sailing, so to be there on the Friday in Rotterdam, we have to sail at 6:30 on Thursday night. They're overnight crossings and you wake up in Rotterdam, so we can't do it. I thought we could at first, but we can't. So when we're in, we've got the Thursday in Hull, the Friday, the Saturday in Rotterdam, sail overnight on the Saturday, so we're back in Hull on the Sunday, and then we'll be in Hull probably till about midday on the Monday, and then we'll drive back home. So during that time I'm going to be visiting all the locations that I use in the book. So some of those are they're all throughout Hull. They're around the dock area, around the River Hull area. We're going to be over at North Ferriby, over on the beach there, the foreshore by North Ferriby. So I've got various places to visit within Hull. So a load of my old haunts, some in the city centre, some outside the city centre. I've arranged to meet up for coffee with a podcast listener and soon-to-be Hull beta reader, Claire Jennison. And I must mention Claire this week because she's just released The Desperate Wife through Bloodhound Books. And she's landed herself this week's at amazingly high Amazon bestsellers rank. So congratulations, Claire. That's brilliant. And it's done through Bloodhound Books. And you know how long I've been interested in getting involved in Bloodhound Books for a long, long time. So I'm looking forward to talking to Claire about that. But we're meeting up for a coffee in Hull next week, which is always one of the great things about travel. If I can meet up with podcast listeners en route. Going to look at all those settings. We're going to Rotterdam. When we're going through the ferry system, I'll be taking pictures of the ferry system, because if I do continue writing books in this series, then I'm going to use the ferries for one of them, because it's an obvious thing to use. So I'll set one of them on the ferries. Now, when I worked at the radio station, it's a bit like Fawlty Towers, this. I can remember they used to do listener trips. I don't think I ever went on a listener trip, but they used to do listener trips where the presenters and staff would go across either to Zeebrugge, I think they don't do Zeebrugge anymore from Hull, I don't think, and to Rotterdam. They'd do a listener's trip, and then they'd have, you know, fun and go and look round the city at the other end. And it was just one of those things they did once a year. But they once had somebody die on one of the listener's trips on the ferry, and you obviously had to, it was a bit like Fawlty Towers, if you've ever seen that episode where somebody dies in the hotel and they're trying to get the body out without anybody seeing it. It was a bit like that. So, I mean, there's plenty of scope for drama on one of the ferries. And while we're in Rotterdam, we're going to do a park run in Rotterdam as well. So there's lots planned over those few days. So that we're doing that from Wednesday afternoon. My wife finishes work at lunchtime on Wednesday. We'll hop in the car, drive over to Hull. So we'll have the Wednesday evening, the Thursday, then we're in Rotterdam Friday, Saturday, back in Hull Sunday, Monday morning, and then we're off. So it's going to be quite a packed, intense time while we're there. I wanted also to mention to you Google Analytics. I should have actually mentioned this when I was giving you my little tech transitions update a moment or two ago. But I got an email from Google Analytics this week, and I'll read this to you. Your Google Analytics account needs immediate attention. Our next generation measurement solution, Google Analytics 4, is replacing Universal Analytics. On 1st of July 2023, standard Universal Analytics properties will stop processing new data. So blah, 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 blah. This is what I said to you was going to happen. Presumably, if you use Google Analytics, you will have also received this email. There was a little button on the email that said, if you want to start the migration process, you could do it now. So I clicked on the button to see what it did. And it looked for a moment like it was going to be a single button click simplicity. And I thought, oh, this is encouraging. But it wasn't. There were about seven steps involved. Now, as I've said to you previously, I'm using Piwik.pro. And I'm very happy. I had another look at Piwik.pro, looked at the analytics, and it's doing exactly what the old style Google used to do for me. Now, I'm not running a big web business. My website isn't a huge, it's not a big deal, because I sell most of my books on through Facebook and through Amazon, and I get my analytics through the what are they called, the tracking links in Amazon. So that's really the most important data to me. If there was ever a point in the future when I started selling directly or started using Shopify, it would be really important for me to get those analytics right. But my website's just a nice to have, an extra. It does surprisingly good traffic according to the analytics. I'm quite surprised about that, but it's not a big part of my business. So I'm happy at the moment with Pyrrhic. The pain of me having to learn a brand new process with Google Analytics 4 rather than just using Pyrrhic Pro, which just gives me what I used to have with Google, that's the decision I'm making for the time being. I would probably have to take that more seriously if anything changes in the future, but at the moment, that's the right decision for me, and I'm quite happy with that. And another thing I did this week is I have renewed my membership of the Alliance of Independent Authors, and I've decided to renew that at authorpreneur level again. Now, if you remember, I've joined the Crime Writers Association. I've been thinking about the Society of Authors, joining that again, and I've decided to rejoin at authorpreneur level. Now, I joined the Alliance of Independent Authors authorpreneur level the year before last, when I'd got the number of book sales that I needed to join at authorpreneur level. And then last year, I joined primarily because I was really worried at that time that I might get into trouble with Amazon, they might block my account or something like that, and I wanted to have that kind of higher level of access with Ally in case I needed any kind of representation there. So the year after, my confidence was up and I thought, oh, I'll just go back to the normal level, it's fine. But this year, because I'm thinking of potentially doing a course and potentially changing slightly what I do in the business, I've decided that I want to join all these, if you want, positioning memberships that just, if you want, have a slightly higher status. So the Crime Writing Association I wanted to have because I'm interested in the networking opportunities there. I need to be mixing more with crime people. I need to hit that social scene more. With the Alliance of Independent Authors, when you join at authorpreneur level, you get business development advice, you get a dedicated literary agent, there's a rights and contract consultancy, and there's business tax, legal and contract advice and resources as well. So it's just a more business-oriented level. And for the next 2 years, I want that when I'm looking at moving my business on. So I have rejoined at authorpreneur level. Now, to join at authorpreneur level, you have to be able to prove that you've sold over 50,000 books in the past 2 years. I was having problems. I don't use book, what's it called now? Book, whatever it's called, that gives you your nice stats. I don't use it anymore because I use the stats now directly that Kindle give you. I find those stats perfectly adequate for telling me what I'm earning on a daily basis. So I've stopped using that now. But when I tried to get the last 2 years' results using Amazon, for some reason it wouldn't give me a full just 2 years. When I used the custom setting, it wouldn't give me 2 years, and then I could use this year or last year, but it wouldn't let me just say, oh, I want it from, for instance, the day I'm recording this, the 13th of May 2021 to the 12th of May 2023. It wouldn't hold there. It would only give me, was it about 15 months, something like that. So anyhow, I got the evidence from 15 months, and as it turned out, it was over 50,000 books in whatever it was, 15, 16, however many months it was that it gave me. So I sent that off to Ally and said, look, I can't get this thing to work, but there's the evidence of the 50,000 books in less than 2 years. Hopefully that's okay. And they've said, yeah, that, you know, that's fine. You just need the evidence of the 50,000 books. So even though I'm not selling books at the same level as I was during COVID, I was pleased to see that I'm still very easily making that entrepreneur level as determined by the Alliance of Independent Authors. So that's 50,000 books sold in 2 years. Now, I haven't sold 50,000 books in 2 years. I've sold about 25,000 books in 2 years, and I've sold the equivalent of that in page reads. So what I have to show them is my several million page reads I've had, and then I always say to them, look, well, I assume a book is about 250 about 250 pages. That's pretty well what my books are. It's probably less than that, to be honest with you, to be fair. But I say 250 pages, and I divide up my page reads, and then that gives me a number of books sold. And I tell them what the basis of the maths is, and they let me have that. But we were over 50,000 books in however many months it was I gave them. So I was just personally quite pleased to see that I'm still hitting those numbers, even though I'm not at the dizzy heights that I was during COVID. I am still hitting the numbers easily to hit that authorpreneur level. So what does it give me? Well, it gives me some extra access in terms of business building and development. And I also get to put that little badge on the website, which is, you know, just quite a nice thing to show off, because it says you're an author who's turning over a certain number of books. So again, you don't really need authorpreneur unless you're probably at a slightly more advanced stage of the business, and that's really why I'm doing it, because I kind of want to be looking at things, I want to be considering things at a slightly more advanced level as I move forward. You know, things like you know, foreign rights, possibly getting a literary agent to manage that, looking at money and tax matters a little bit more closely, just more sort of business building things to move things on to the next phase. So that's primarily why I've joined. I've got a whole load of links to share this week. I'll rattle through these as quickly as I can just to give you a taster. But remember, the links are always on the show notes at selfpublishingjourneys.com. I've got a draft digital blog post entitled Beta Readers versus ARC Readers, What's the Difference? And I kind of really put this on for my benefit, because I use those phrases interchangeably. You know, I always talk about beta readers and ARC readers. And if you push me on it, I do know the difference. I know I use them carelessly and interchangeably. So I thought, well, there you go. Here's the definitive blog on it. I'll share that with everybody so we know what the difference is. So that's as much for my benefit as it is for yours. I've got a couple of articles from the novelry.com. Now, the Novelry is a writer's site, and I think predominantly they do support for authors through courses. And I just wanted to share a couple of these with you. They've got an interview with Paula Hawkins about how do you write a bestseller. Paula Hawkins is the lady who wrote Girl on a Train, so that's well worth a look. We've got a question and answer live, again with a thriller author who was part of the Pro Writing Aid series, and I really enjoyed his presentation, A.A. Dehand. Lots of advice on being a bestseller, writing a bestseller, so I thought that was useful as well. Another one from the Novelry, basically the elements of crime fiction, which elements of crime fiction can make your novel stand out to readers and publishers. And then also another great article here about suspense writing tips for authors. Now, clearly they're more oriented to my genre, but I know that a lot of you write in that genre, so I'll share those as well. I've got a post that I thought might be quite interesting for you if you are newer to writing. And these are 7 tips about publishing in KDP Select. 7 tips and bits of advice from the Alliance of Independent Authors. That's on the show notes this week. I have another post from Writer's Digest at writersdigest.com. And this is called Writing Mistakes That Are Holding You Back. So writing mistakes that writers make that hold them back. We could always do with an article about that, can't we? But I'm sharing these because they're just easily digestible, and they're just nice quick reads where you can not spend ages reading them, but just leave with a load of good ideas. That's why I'm sharing them. And then also, just as a reminder, I've shared that Christine Catherine Rush post about Chris's comments on KDP Select and why you should consider publishing wide. It certainly will give you food for thought, but for the reasons I've already told you, I would just lose too much income at the moment pivoting from KDP Select. But that doesn't mean, I know that it's not the right long-term strategy, but that's why my sci-fi is wide, my non-fiction is wide, and I'm going to make those first tentative steps of putting my future thrillers wide and just starting to build out a bit more now. In personal news, I'm listening to at the moment a book called The Luck Factor. Now, I've read this book before and I really like it. It's a scientific study of the lucky mind. It's a book by Richard Wiseman. I've read this book before and I just wanted to revisit it. And I'm just listening to the audio on something like 1.5 speed at the moment. But it's just about when, if any of us who write, if we got a book picked up, say, by a big author, it became a bestseller and they made a film or a TV series of it, you can bet your bottom dollar that people who know you would say, oh, you're lucky. They'd say you're lucky. And we all know that it's taken hours of work and grind and anxiety to get these books out. So we know that it's anything but lucky, that the luck has been created by us putting ourselves in the path of luck. We've done the work. We've had the blood, sweat and tears. That we weren't lucky. It appears that we are, but we had to put ourselves in the path of luck to become lucky. And I'm really interested in this concept of, are you lucky or unlucky, and how do you put yourself in the path of luck? So I'm revisiting this book because it's great. It's a really interesting scientific study into people who think they're lucky and people who don't think they're lucky. So I'll put a show note link to that. It's The Luck Factor, The Scientific Study of the Lucky Mind by Richard Wiseman. And I'm also continuing to read Exit Stage Left, which is this book I mentioned last week about pop stars after they've been famous. And every case I read in this book just makes me come up with the phrase income producing assets. The number of pop stars I'm reading about here who have had fallen fortunes, drug, alcohol, you know, all the problems and band bust-ups, everything on earth that you can think that happened to pop stars is covered in this book. But what really rings true constantly throughout the whole book is that because they've created assets, music, people's interest comes back. People buy these or license these pieces of music for films, or they license them for adverts. Think of Kate Bush in Stranger Things. And that this can happen to us at any time as authors as well. There are so many lessons about what we do in that book for pop stars. So I'm enjoying that and then making my way through that book as well. Healthy author updates. Well, on Wednesday this week, I did a 10K run. It was very muddy. We ran by the castle in Carlisle and it was incredibly muddy. And at one point we all had to queue. It was so slow over the mud we had to queue, but it was a lovely run. You know, all the we ran through trees and all round by the river and everything in Carlisle. It was lovely. Did I say Hull earlier? I meant Carlisle if I said Hull. And it was a lovely run, quite tiring, but I really enjoyed it. So that was on Wednesday. I'm doing the normal park run on Saturday, but probably at a different location on Saturday. I am doing a 5k at the nature reserve on Sunday. I did a treadmill on Monday or Tuesday this week, and I got my two weights exercises in again this week. I think I did them on Monday and Wednesday. On Wednesday, I had a double. I did my weights exercises at lunch. I did my 10K in the evening, so I was quite tired on Wednesday. So I'm you know, in the swing of all the exercising and all of that thing. And last week at Carlisle, I hit my 100th park run. At Carlisle, I've done 144 park runs in total, but that was my 100th in Carlisle. If you want to take a look at my healthy author updates and images, you will find those at paulteague.net/run. Okay, that's it for this week's show. As we're away in Hull and Rotterdam next week, I'm not going to have the opportunity to record a regular podcast diary for next Saturday. So instead, I have recorded a special one-off episode, which I'm really looking forward to sharing with you. It's recorded already, so I've listened through to it. I think it works well. I'm going to be sharing with you next week my worst book reviews, my one stars, and my best book reviews, my five stars. And I'm going to be discussing how much bad reviews used to bother me and why things have changed in my attitude towards reviews since I started selling more books through effective advertising. Also next week, I've got a just for fun competition for you in which you can try and guess which one star review belongs to me and which one star review belongs to a mega author. I've got seven of these. Some of them are mine, some of them are mega authors. And when I tested this on my wife, just to make sure it wasn't obvious, she didn't get any of them right. she couldn't distinguish my one-star reviews between the one-star reviews of the mega authors. And what I've used AI for next week is I've used AI to read the reviews rather than me reading them all, which would get a bit tedious. I've used different AI voices to read the reviews out for you. So I think it works well as an episode. You'll soon find out, because you'll get to listen to it next week. So until then, that is it for this week's show. Thank you so much for listening again. I hope you have a great week of writing. From me, Paul Teague, it is bye-bye for now.